Hey listeners, a quick message before the episode. We wanted to let you know that until January 24, The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald are offering 50% off essential weekend subscription packages. So that means you can get 6 months of weekend paper deliveries and unlimited digital access for just $3.95 a week. Becoming a subscriber also gets you a bunch of perks, exclusive behind-the-scenes content, invitations to special events, and unlimited access on all your devices. So if you've been meaning to get signed up for a while, January is the time to do it. Just follow the link in our show notes or search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. Now, to the episode.
As we enter the new year, one thing about Australia is increasingly clear. Our economy, having racked up a record run of 28 consecutive years of growth, has entered into a delicate new phase.
Interest rates remain on hold.
House prices will continue to fall for all of the next year into 2020.
Productivity and profits are up. Why is wage growth stuck?
Australian house prices have finally ceased their extraordinary run and started falling back down to earth. Having sat on its hands with interest rates at record lows for more than 2 years, the Reserve Bank is keeping close watch for signs it can begin raising rates to normal levels. But as the property market unwinds, there's even been talk of another rate cut. Adding further to uncertainty, Australia's Royal Commission into Misconduct in the Finance Sector is set to hand down its final report by the end of this month. And global investors remain on their toes as doubts linger over Brexit and the US economy and China continue trading tariff blows. All this in the lead-up to a federal election in Australia, where both sides will be vying for the title of Best Economic Manager.
And we can guarantee stronger budget surpluses.
And their economic plan is working.
One thing's for sure, economy watching in 2019 will be fascinating. But what will it all mean for you? Welcome to Season 2 of Please Explain, a weekly podcast from The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Each episode, you get the full story on some of the most significant issues facing Australia and a look inside the newsrooms that bring them to you. I'm Jessica Irvine, a senior economics writer and stand-in host this week for Tory Maguire. Hello and welcome. Kicking off this new year right, this episode we've decided to assemble our crack team of economic experts to help you make sense of what's to come for your wealth, your mortgage and your pay packet. Joining me to discuss all this and more is economics editor of the Sydney Morning Herald and the granddaddy of Australian economics himself, Ross Gittins. Hi,
hi,
Ross. And today we have the pleasure of officially welcoming to the economics team Shane Wright, who is our new senior economics correspondent, and he's joining us from Federal Parliament in Canberra. Hi, Shane.
Hello, Jess, and hello to Granddaddy Ross.
Thank you.
Later on, we'll also be hearing from the analyst who's forecast those huge 30% home price drops in Sydney and Melbourne, and I'll be asking him just how he's backing those claims up. But first, gentlemen, we've got serious matters to discuss. And Shane, if you don't already know, if you want to join the economics team at The Herald and The Age, we have a strict dress code here enforced by Ross. It consists of trainers. You must wear sneakers every day, although Ross is flouting his own standards today by wearing sandals.
Yes, but I stepped them up from thongs. I wouldn't appear in the office in thongs. Except maybe on the weekend.
Requirement number two is that you must have an outlandish taste in ties. Ross is constantly wearing these amazing floral numbers that he's brought back from some European holiday. Have you got an outlandish tie that you can wear?
Well, I would never call my flying pig tie outlandish. It has been with me for about let's see, this will be my 21st federal budget. It's been with me for about 19 of them. And it's now being teamed with a pair of flying pig socks, a lovely pink pair. Just to reinforce the point, whenever you walk into a budget lockup, you know you've got a better chance of seeing a flying pig than getting the real truth about the state of the economy or the state of the books.
Well, it sounds like you're going to fit right in, and welcome to the team, Shane. So let's get cracking. I think the thing that we most watch in economics, the thing we all debate, people want to know about interest rates. Let's just get straight into that. And Shane, I wanted to ask you first, I mean, we've got a Reserve Bank who's had interest rates jacked down at record lows for more than 2 years now. And you'd have to think they're keen to sort of change that and eventually get things back to more normal. But at the end of last year, people started to really talk about interest rate cuts. How did we get to that situation where we're talking about interest rate cuts?
Well, we're getting a bit into what's going on with the housing market and what's coming in from overseas. I think the futures market have got about a 50-50 chance of a rate cut over the next 18 months or so. So the markets are saying, like, the people who've got money invested in this space are saying, whoops, the RBA, Phil Lowe, they're going to have to change tack sooner or later. The RBA is giving the message across, well, look, we think the most likely avenue is it's going to go up. But who knows? Depends what crazy Donald gets up to in the US, what happens in terms of bond yields there, and what that flow and the Federal Reserve get up to. Then you're getting into Brexit. Then you're getting into all sorts of other international events flowing into what's going on here at home. And those house prices in Sydney and Melbourne are a very big economic factor at the moment.
And I guess that people worry about a negative wealth effect is what we're talking about there. If people feel less rich, they're going to spend less money in the stores. But we sort of haven't seen that happen yet. And Ross, what do you think is the likelihood that we'll see interest rates go even lower from where they are?
Well, I think there's some likelihood. You'd be mad to say it's not possible to happen. But I don't think it's a certainty by any means. It's really interesting now because until a couple of months ago, the Reserve Bank and the Treasury were convinced that the economy was really going to move up a gear. It was going to grow at a above trend rate, above 3% for a couple of years. It was all going to be much nicer and much more scope for people to get pay rises. But the latest figures and worries about the housing market and worries about what's happening overseas has caused people to think, well, maybe we're not going to speed up. Maybe we might be slowing down. And so we're in this strange situation where some people are saying, those idiots at the Reserve Bank, why aren't they putting interest rates up? And then another bunch of people are saying, those idiots at the Reserve Bank, why aren't they putting rates down? Well, actually, I often think that if you take those two and average them, what you get is no change, and that's probably the most likely thing. But let me just say also that if you think that another fall in interest rates is good news, you don't know much about how economies work. Interest rates come down when the economy isn't growing fast enough. When the economy is growing strongly and everybody's drinking champagne, interest rates go up.
So nobody should really be hoping for interest rate cuts from here now, I don't
know. No, and you wouldn't. And even though as a prospective home buyer you might like that, or somebody who's already got a loan, you might think that sounds nice. It means that the general economic circumstances in which that happened will be less positive than they are right now.
And it might mean the bottom's about to fall out of your home value as well, if that's what they're responding to. Shane, we talked about pay rises there. And one of the central things that really has been puzzling economists has been why we haven't seen wages pick up. Now, we did see unemployment drop to sort of 5%, which is at about what economists call the NARU, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment.
It's non-accelerating inflation. It needs a hyphen between the inflation and the accelerating and the inflation. It's inflation that's not accelerating, and that's... It describes what the unemployment rate is when inflation isn't accelerating.
Yes, and we're at it, or we're about at best estimates of it. Shane, do you reckon this is a good year to ask for a pay rise?
any year's a good year to ask for a pay rise. It's whether the person you're asking is going to give it to you. That's the biggest problem. And we've seen this, and it is quite interesting that this is a global phenomena that is going on. You've had, say, the chief economist of the Bank of England, Andy Hadland, has been talking about this, and he's pointed to the fact in Britain, saying that the effective power of employees to ask for a pay rise is back to where it was pre the creation of the cotton gin. We've had such a big change in the power dynamics in workforces, and we've seen it, say, where were the last week, the US, where you had about 300,000 jobs created over the past month, and yet that is not leading to a huge pickup in wages growth.
Yeah, which is what the whole idea of a Nehru is really saying. When the unemployment rate gets down to this level, that's when you start to see big pay rises that start pushing inflation back up. And that's what's not happening. But actually, one possible explanation for that is the Nehru is actually lower than the 5% that the Reserve Bank and Treasury assume it to be.
Yeah, it seems like we're waiting now to sort of see if the basic laws of supply and demand work as they used to, and people sort of thinking it might need to go lower before we do get those pay rises. I guess one of the offshoots of that is that there's sort of less growth in income tax collections, although the budget bottom line has been doing pretty well of late, and we know we're going to have a budget on April 2, which is a little bit earlier than usually, which might mean it's a little bit warmer in Canberra when we all have to come down for budget lockup.
Budget will be hotter, you can be sure of that.
It will be. So, Shane, what are we expecting?
Oh, toughen up, you pair. Look, the Canberra winter, it's bracing. That's what you need in your life.
Now, what are we expecting to see, Shane, from the budget that Scott Morrison will unveil? It's supposed to be the launching off point for the federal election campaign. So how good are the books?
The books are in pretty reasonable condition, especially given how much tax is flowing from the corporate sector. They've really picked up some of that slack that we've seen that cursed Wayne Swan and Chris Bowen and Joe Hockey. So we've seen that real lift. The stronger overall jobs market is giving more flow through from the income tax side. Except, of course, Treasury is still forecasting huge lifts in wages, which they've been doing for 6 years and have been getting wrong for 6 years. So the starting point is we're looking at a surplus, supposedly, of between about $4 billion for 1920. That's the big mark that they want to hit, that Josh Frydenberg wants to jump up and down about. First surplus since 07-08. The question is, how much are they going to spend to stay in office? And Ross, you've seen plenty of pre-election budgets. You know what they're like.
Well, I think so, and I think that if they're pinning their hopes on this, budgets, we've learnt, don't have much effect on polls, but unless they're really bad. But when you have a government that in the face of that is saying, well, there's an election coming up in May, so we're going to have our budget just at the start of the campaign, essentially. It will kick off the campaign, and that will be our big chance of getting votes back and winning the election. That tells you it has to be a budget that's got a lot of giveaways in it. And that also tells you, so despite all the noises that they've made about the need to get the budget back to surplus, it could be in a much bigger surplus if they hadn't been giving so much away in recent times. In fact, what's happened is that as the tax revenue has looked much better than they were expecting, they've spent a fair bit of it.
Which is actually contravening one of their own budget rules.
It is. This is not about economics. This is about politics. These guys are desperate, and if they have to run a surplus that's tiny, and $4 billion is in an economy the size of Australia is so tiny, you could regard it as a balanced budget. So that's, I mean, it's got a plus sign in front of it, so it's a surplus. But when you're that close to zero, $4 billion is not a lot of money in an economy as big as ours, which is about getting on for $2 trillion worth of income a year. $4 billion out of $2 trillion ain't a lot.
Now, Shane, one of the things that's going to be big in the election campaign, and it always is this idea of who's the better economic manager. If you had to call it, who do you reckon can lay better claim to that title of best economic manager?
Oh, now you've put me on the spot with that question, Jess, because it is so tied up in politics. Now, you could mount a case, if you're looking just at budget bottom lines, and this is the problem, economics for the general public has become who's running a budget surplus or big deficits, or as opposed to the general economy avoiding huge increases in unemployment, wages growth, business development, business creation. And I get to the point that it's just a wash. It is ultimately just a wash between the two of them. Would, for instance, how would Costello and Howard have handled the Great Recession or the GFC? You can tell that Treasury would have been giving them the same advice that Rudd and Swan ultimately took, the same advice that Morrison has been getting in the wake of the disastrous 2014 budget, which in terms of the politics was horrendous, and the economics, the Senate effectively saved some of the economic pain that would likely come out of it. So it all comes down to whether you equate the bottom line figure with whether someone's a good economic manager or not, and I don't.
Well, I certainly wouldn't judge it on the budget deficit. I mean, the budget balance is important, but it's not the economy. The economy is important. If the budget deficit is important, and I think it is, the budget balance, it's because of its effects on the economy, because it's the economy that's important, really. In other words, the budget balance is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. But in any case, getting back to the question of who's the better, which side is better, I don't play that game because it's too hard. You can do it literally. You can say, well, look, during these months, Labor's in power and we've averaged out how the economy was going. And during these months for the past decade or two decades, and by the way, if I don't get the right answer with one decade, then I'll make it two or three till I get the right answer to suit my politics. You play those games. You can do that, but they don't impress me, because when government changes, it inherits the economy that it got from the last lot. And those effects can last for not for the first 6 months, but maybe for the first 5 years to some extent. And that makes it impossible to make sensible judgments when government is changing hands reasonably often. That makes it impossible to make sensible judgments that aren't just arbitrary. And so I don't play that game.
Yeah, I mean, it was the whole point of some of the reforms of the 80s and 90s that the economy is less at the behest of the economic
yes,
managers.
Yes, and that is a very good point. What no one in Canberra wants to remember, and certainly not the politicians on either side, is that the economy is actually run in Martin Place in Sydney by the Reserve Bank day to day. And so if the economy is going well, most of the credit will go not to the government, but to the guys who are manning the levers in Martin Place. That's actually part of the reason why everybody in the country who doesn't work in Martin Place thinks they know better how to do the Reserve Bank's job than it does.
Well, I've got to the point, Ross, of when I've particularly say a government minister saying, oh, look, we're running the budget's going well, we're running a good economy. I say, what the Reserve Bank's got rates at 1.5%. You don't think they've played an important role, an overwhelmingly important role? Like, remember when we talked about the size of deficits and or surpluses, and whether this was crowding out private investment and the swings and roundabouts of macro economics, or the macroeconomic effect of the budget? We've forgotten what's going on with the cost of money in this country.
Because it's not convenient. People in political journalists in Canberra don't want to say, well, look, actually, what these guys that we make our living talking about do isn't very important. It's all those guys sitting in that office block in Martin Place. That's very important. But, of course, we don't know much about that.
Which is not to say that the politicians don't have anything to do with the economy. And Shane, one of the big things that seems to be starting the year is this relentless attack by the Coalition against Labor's plans on housing tax reform. How do you think that's going to play out? And do you actually think Labor will actually proceed with the policies that it has announced?
Well, second question first. I think they will, because they need the cash that will be raised to pay for their promises. So they're sort of locked in on that front. In terms of the government will hammer this, every piece, every brick, every kitchen fit out, every new gutter around the country, that's what they're going to argue about from here until polling day, because they don't have all that much else to attack. This is, in terms of a house, for most people, it's their single biggest investment. The government knows this is the one area that they are going to be able to throw everything at. They will never be able to be held to account, really, because in terms of the macroeconomic impact or the impact of these changes, there's a lot of debate from both sides. So they are going to go every day, every week of the campaign. You're going to see a mention of negative gearing or cap gains in that space.
And Ross, when people are hearing that sort of bluster and noise, what's your opinion on the package that Labor has crafted with curbing negative gearing and capital gains tax?
My opinion is that it could be better than it is, but that there's nothing wrong with it. It's not going to destroy anything. I think that's true in principle. I'm not completely certain that the timing of when you introduce it doesn't affect what's happening to house prices, right? It's not so much it as people's expectations about it. And because the property prices are about confidence, and negative gearing and the changes to the capital gains tax, which are probably more important, they can affect confidence and expectations about the future. And so this is going to be a pretty tricky thing. I think one of the big unknowns is what's going to happen to property prices. It's the second big unknown. First big unknown is what's going to happen to wages. And if wages don't start growing more in a more healthy way fairly soon, the economy is not going to be all that flash. But to get back to house prices, that is a big uncertainty. Are prices just going to keep slowly drifting down? We're really only talking about Sydney and Melbourne, but they're pretty important. Or are they going to start falling quite rapidly? Because if they do start falling rapidly, there is a case to say that's going to scare a lot of people. And I don't like this wealth effect thing. It's just the atmospherics. The atmospherics of prices coming down very rapidly are atmospherics where you say, I think things are so uncertain. I was planning to do this, but I'll just wait a few months. And if too many people decide that, then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The economy is weaker than you thought. The economy was getting weaker, and guess what? You were right. And it was right because so many people thought the same way you did and acted accordingly.
Thanks for that, Ross. That leads us perfectly into the next interview that I have coming up about house prices. But thanks for joining me today, both of you, Shane and Ross, and welcome again to the team, Shane. It's great to have you on board.
We're selling. Make no mistake, ladies and gentlemen, you don't bid now. The sold sign goes out the front and you've well and truly missed your chance. We will be welcoming your new owners rather here this morning, and the bid's in your favour, ma'am. Good luck and look on. $1,435,000 for the third and final time. When the contract hits my hand, We will not reopen. No late bids, sir. Have I got your best? We're going to sell it, ladies and gentlemen. No late bids. What do we say? Third and final time. Good luck, ma'am. Look on at 14:35. We are selling. We are selling. You sure, sir? They're sold. Congratulations. Well bought. 1,435,000.
House prices. Is there any topic more certain to stir the passions or inflame the fears of Aussies? For half a decade, house prices in Sydney and Melbourne were on the up and up and up. But last year, prices fell by around 9% in Sydney and 7% in Melbourne, according to CoreLogic. So how low will home prices go? Many economists are tipping total falls in the order of 20% in Sydney and Melbourne. And at the outer edge is Martin North, who's going further and tipping total price falls of around 30%. Martin is the principal of the research and consultancy firm Digital Finance Analytics, which runs a regular survey of 52,000 households. And he joins me now all the way from Wollongong. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
That figure of 30% seems pretty out there. Can you explain how you arrive at that forecast?
Yeah, sure. So it's not just plucked out of the thin air, as it were. It's actually based on some quite detailed analytical work that we do. So we survey households and we look at their finances and we look at the impact of the credit boom that we've had over the last decade on those house prices and on households. And essentially, by running that through our modelling, we can come up with some estimates based on a number of different scenarios. So, you know, it does depend a little bit on what happens internationally and locally. But I think in the major centres, there is plenty of downside risk ahead based on the fact that credit growth drives house prices and credit growth is coming off strongly. Property investors are definitely voting with their feet and standing on the sidelines, and there's very little evidence from my surveys that any of those are going to come back anytime soon. And overseas buyers are also stepping back too. So effectively, demand is off. There's plenty of supply, 200,000 new units coming on stream in the major centres over the next year or so. And credit availability will be much tighter ahead. Put all that into my modelling and I come up with a 25 to 30% possible correction in the major centres over the next two or three years.
So you've literally, the nuts and bolts of that, you've got an Excel spreadsheet or something that has sort of historic data on how things have gone and you match it up to maybe previous price declines or price movements and then you extrapolate? How exactly does that work?
Yeah, so essentially what I've done is I've got a 25-year history in Australia of modelling what's going on. I've also overlaid other house price corrections from around the world, so in Ireland and the UK and the US in 2008 and other ones too. And the bad news is that once home prices begin to slide, it's often the case that they do move into quite negative territory over the following 12 to 18 months. I haven't yet seen any examples internationally of home price falls that don't lead to a significant correction, right? So that's the first point. And I factor that in. I've also taken account of the local situation here in Australia because, of course, many people say, well, Australia is unique and different, you know, and we are uniquely placed for some reason or another. But my view is that actually, if you look under the covers, the very high debt ratios that we have here, the very generous lending standards that we had as exposed in the Royal Commission and everything else, all highlights the fact that we've had very loose standards for a long period of time. So you have to put that into the model as well and effectively crank the handle. It is Excel, actually, but it's quite a complicated model. So it's taking account of international experience, local experience and history, and then trying to work forward based on what we think is going to happen with interest rates and with employment and those things. So it is meant to be relatively scientific and relatively robust. And by the way, we also do it, run it at a postcode level rather than as a national level, because there are some significant variations across states and across postcodes.
Yeah, so within Sydney and Melbourne markets, you're able to see sort of where the biggest falls might be. What sort of areas in those two cities are looking at the biggest pain? Are we in a city, outer suburbs? Where's the pain?
Yeah, well, there are some interesting hotspots. So, for example, over in Western Sydney, you'd expect like Campbelltown and Liverpool, we're already seeing prices down there in some cases 20% off, and we think there's more to go. I see hotspots up on the central coast, and again, prices sliding. They're sliding also in some of the regional centres around, Wollongong, if I take another New South Wales example. But what's also interesting is that we're seeing inner city prices slide. So, for example, Ultimo units are down more than 20% now from their previous peak. So already, and that's just history, so that's basically saying this is what's happened so far. And then, of course, you then say, well, what's going to happen ahead? Because essentially we think the slides are going to continue. And we can do the same in other places. So, for example, that, you know, look down in Victoria or look up in Queensland or even Western Australia, you can actually get right down to individual postcodes. My point is, it's not just the battling urban fringe, you know, the Liverpools and Campbelltowns. There are more affluent suburbs now that are also struggling too. And I'm more concerned actually about price corrections at the top of the market, where in fact, on average, prices have already corrected more than 20% from their previous peaks. So again, averaging masks all of those variations, right? You have to get quite granular. I'm also thinking that there will be other hotspots. Over in Western Australia, for example, we've seen prices there down 15% from their peaks nearly a decade ago now, and I still think there's more to go there. And in Darwin, they're down more than 25% from their peaks. So, you know, we should get used to the fact that prices can go down as well as up.
And one of the key factors will, of course, be the Royal Commission. And we've had Scott Morrison sort of out there saying that perhaps the banks have over-responded or indeed and tightened too much. And maybe we might, if we could encourage the banks to start lending a little bit more, that will sort of take out some of the downside. What do you think we will see after, you know, in a post-Royal Commission world? Have the banks gone too hard and things will go back to as they were? Or are things really going to change and it's going to be harder to get a loan for the future?
Well, I think we're into a new normal. So you can run the argument two ways. Either the banks were lending fine last year, and they've now gone too tight, or they were lending too loose, and the Royal Commission highlighted the fact that, in fact, there were people who got loans they should never have got. Now, I have to say, all the evidence suggests to me that the lending standards were way too loose, and you can look at that in terms of the data. So we know our ratios, if you look at debt to GDP, household debt to GDP, or home prices to income, they're way off the scale, so on an international basis. So my hypothesis is that last year and the last few years, the banks were lending way too loose. That, frankly, if you had a pulse, you'd get a mortgage. You know, they asked almost no questions. And in fact, the Royal Commission highlighted the fact that cost information, expenditure information was just discarded. It never got into the underwriting processes. Now the banks, I think, are actually doing what they should have done. They're obeying the law as originally articulated a few years ago. And so even before the Royal Commission comes out with any recommendations, the banks are rightly tightening. So we're not going to go back, I think, to that very loose lending previously. Now then the question is, what will the Royal Commission say? I think they will say there was some illegal activity. I think they will say that the lending standards were way too loose. They will probably focus on things like household expenditure measures, which is effectively a very rough way to try and estimate how households can service loans. The banks are asking much tighter questions now on income and expenditure and all those things. Those, I think, are going to stay. So therefore, a new normal is in town, and that means that we will not see the same credit boom that we had over the previous decade. And like I said, credit drives home prices. Therefore, tighter credit will have exactly the opposite effect. It will drive prices down. Now, there will probably be some marginal borrowers that should have got loans and didn't get loans, but that's at the margin. Overall, we're not going to see, I think, a return to the last few years.
And I wanted to ask you about Labor's housing tax changes to curb negative gearing and halve the capital gains tax discount on new investment properties. There's a big scare campaign about what impact that will have. Can you quantify what sort of percentage point fall that will contribute to, you know, house prices? Is it big or large? And what do you think of the merits of that policy?
Okay, so let's start with the merits of the policy first. So negative gearing was one of the critical reasons why we had a massive surge in investment lending. So a third of lending is for investment purposes. That's double what it is in the UK. And even at that 16%, the Bank of England in the UK were worried about the risks in the system. So we've had way too much investor lending. That inflated house prices like you wouldn't believe, and you know we've discussed the reasons why credit was too available. So essentially what we're now moving to is to the situation where the investors are less likely to move into the market because they're not seeing any capital gains. So appetite from the investment community is off. The Labour proposals, as I understand them, grandfather existing negative gearing arrangements, so it's new for existing properties. So you can still negatively gear into new property, it's just existing properties. And so if I run that through the model, it's almost a rounding error of the impact on house prices. It's about a 0.25% down across the board. This was really a scare campaign being run partly from a political agenda, I guess, but also from, you know, the construction sector who really want to try and, you know, go back to where we were a couple of years ago. So to my mind, this is the perfect time to address negative gearing and take that highly acceleratory impact out of the system. We don't need it. Frankly, if property investors are only making returns because they can get tax breaks off it, rather than, you know, from good economic reasons, that tells me something that suggests that we should take it away. And by the way, that means the taxpayers are paying for property investors to make a return. That doesn't make sense to me.
Okay, so bigger picture, say we get sort of 20-30% falls, whatever it is, in this market correction. What is the long-term outlook? So I've written about wanting to be a first home buyer. What should young Australians be thinking about, whether they will have that opportunity to ride the train to riches through property? Will we ever see those sorts of gains that we've seen, that we did see over the last period when interest rates, you know, were halved? Do you see that ever working out again?
So if you take a long-term view, in fact, home prices hardly grew at all until quite recently, right? So there was a massive acceleration due to freer lending, due to the you know, the opening up of the financial markets, all of those things. So we have had a rather abnormal period over the last, let's say, 20 years, right? I think we're probably not going to have that again. And by the way, it's not just in Australia, in other places around the world, we're seeing similar things happening. So home prices are beginning to move back to perhaps more normal levels. So if a first-time buyer is thinking about buying into the market, I guess my advice would be, firstly, hold off for the moment, because I think prices will continue to slide and you can probably buy better later, perhaps closer into the city at a lower price. And don't be attracted by these sort of first-time home buyer bribes that are out there. Some of the states are offering them, because essentially what you're doing is you're buying in at the peak or near the peak, and you'll be riding it down. You'll be losing your equity. The banks don't lose theirs first. You lose your equity first. So if you've saved a 10% deposit and you buy, prices drop 10%, you've lost everything, right? So the first thing is, don't buy too soon. The second is, I don't think we're going to see a dive and then a rapid recovery in home prices. My expectation is that we're going to see a slide over 3 or 4 years, and then probably a sideways trajectory for another 4 or 5 years. The best analogy is probably Japan, where in fact that's what's happened to prices there. The fundamental supply demand has changed. The credit availability has changed. So we're in a new normal. And what that means is that there's more opportunity for first-time buyers down the track to get into the market. There's less competition with property investors who were driving the market too high. And by the way, overseas in property buyers are also now walking away as well. So I think there will be more supply. I think there'll be more opportunity to buy. And by the way, I think the banks will be quite happy to lend later to first-time buyers, even up to 90-95% once prices have settled. So I think you need to take a 2 to 3 to 5 year view of this, rather than sort of the next 18 months or even 12 months. And I've had a number of people approach me who are first-time buyers saying, gee, should I buy now? And I say, well, I would hold off. I think you can probably get a better deal later.
Okay, thanks very much, Martin, for talking to us today. I really appreciate it. I guess time will tell. We'll see. Thanks very much.
As with all of this, time will indeed tell. Good talk to you. Thanks.
Thanks to Ross Gittins, Shane Wright and Martin North for joining me on the podcast today. If you know someone who would enjoy this week's episode, make sure you share it with them, or better yet, grab their phones and get them subscribed to get new episodes every week. We hope you enjoyed the first episode of our New Sound second season. You can always get in touch with the team via the email address on our website. Just pop Please Explain Podcast into your search engine to find it. This podcast is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Don't forget about our half-price summer sale on subscriptions to support our work. The link, as always, is in our show notes. This episode was produced and edited by David Estcourt and Rachel Dexter. Technical assistance from Yuji Shimada, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Jessica Irvine. Thanks for listening.